Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Office of Family Assistance Welfare Peer Technical Assistance Network Team Parenting Webinar. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. If you would like to ask a question during the presentation, please use the chat feature located in the lower left corner of your screen. If you need to reach an operator at any point, please press star zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded, Thursday, August 2nd, 2012. I would now like to turn the conference over to Ms. Lisa Washington-Thomas, Technical Assistance Branch Chief for the Office of Family Assistance. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our overview of programs providing services to low-income teen parents. As Krista said, I'm the Technical Assistance Branch Chief in the Office of Family Assistance, and this webinar on teen parent programs has been developed to highlight the program design and implementation of two programs serving low-income teen parents. We'll also provide information to TANF organizations on program models for serving low-income teen parents, discuss key partnerships and strategies for developing partnerships, and share strategies for overcoming challenges and barriers to service delivery. Next slide, please. Our agenda is pretty packed. We'll go over overview of the results of a Minnesota technical assistance request. And then we are so glad to have presentations from Jennifer Johnson and Kara Wendt from Ohio Learning, Earning, and Parenting Program, Ohio LEAP, as well as presentations from Danette Lawrence and Henry Jones from DC Parent Assessment Programs. This will be followed by a question and answer session, which Chris has mentioned that you can submit questions through the chat button on your left. As well as a polling session to see how well the webinar was received. Thank you. Next slide. So throughout the webinar, you have the opportunity to submit your questions through the chat button. And not necessarily through the hands raised button. We see a hand raised, but I don't see the question in the chat section. So next slide, please. So in 2010, Minnesota submitted a peer technical assistance request wanting to know more information about teen parent programs across the country. The Minnesota Department of Human Services was primarily interested in programs that focused on reducing disparities in African American and Native American youth, supporting mechanisms and programs for supporting foster children, the age out of care and unlikely to join the TANF program caseload as teen parents, support for non-custodial fathers, and resources and supports for teen parents with mental health and or chemical health issues. In response to this request, we examined 21 teen parent programs from across the United States. We looked at areas such as key goals, service delivery, staffing, training, partnerships, programs and services for teens aging out of foster care, and outcomes measured by the program. Of those 21 programs, we noticed that several had similar goals. Nine of the programs that we reviewed had a goal of improving educational and economic outcomes for teen parents through education, training, life skills, and work. We had seven programs whose goal were preventing subsequent births and sexually transmitted diseases. Four different programs across the country had a goal of promoting healthy children, parents, and families. And the following goals had three different programs across the country that were interested in reducing the incidence of low birth weight babies and improving other birth outcomes, increasing developmental outcomes and school readiness levels for children of teen parents, and teaching positive parenting and parenting skills and attitudes. The individual program profiles and analysis of all 21 programs can be found on the Welfare Peer TA Network website. And that website is http://peerta.acf.hhs.gov. I'm so happy this afternoon to be joined this webinar by two programs that participated in the Minnesota Teen Parent Technical Assistance Request. The first program we will be hearing from is Ohio LEAP, and the second with Ms. Jennifer Johnson and Ms. Kara Wendt. These two programs have two things in common, probably many more, but they both put a special emphasis on case management, and they both offer services to non-custodial teen dads. So I would like to turn this over to Ms. Jennifer Johnson and Ms. Kara Wendt from Ohio LEAP. Thank you.
Good afternoon. This is Kara with the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services. In my role at the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services, I deal with the policy regarding our Ohio Works First program. Ohio Works First is our TNF program, of which a part of it is our Learning, Earning, and Parenting program. That is, the purpose is to support teens who are either pregnant or parenting. I'd like to start by giving you a brief overview of Ohio's makeup. There we go. So Ohio is a state-supervised, county-administered state. We have 88 county agencies that we deal with, and all 88 county agencies have an office that determines our eligibility determination and do our work requirements. So they assign the work activities or they partner with someone in their community to do that, and they are also in turn responsible for determining who would be good candidates for the LEAP program. In May 2012, for Ohio Works First, our caseload was 76,358 assistance groups, which is generally the same as a household. That assistance group size contributed to 159,034 individuals receiving Ohio Works First. 122,000 in that group were children. So we were looking at the adults, you know, for our work activities, and this program obviously crosses over those under 19. So it also it affects our children population, our child population. For April of 2012, our LEAP caseload was approximately 1,800 participants. So that's our general overview of our state makeup, how we administer our programs, and our caseload for the entire Ohio Works First program. And now when we go into our LEAP population, we're discussing that 1,800, a little over 1,800 person caseload. The LEAP program has been in existence since 1988. Our agency worked with the Ohio General Assembly to come up with a program that would specifically benefit the population of children 19 years or younger that were either pregnant or parenting, to assist them in completing school. And as I stated, because Ohio is a state-supervised, county-administered state, our county agencies are responsible for identifying the candidates that are participating in the Ohio Works First program that would benefit from this program. The next slide gives you some of the details on where this is in our Ohio Revised Code, if you were interested in how it was established in state law. And it also gives our rule. In Ohio, we do administrative code rules that govern the existence of our programs and set forth the eligibility requirements. So these will be good references for you to look at after the presentation. Jennifer will go through the details of this program, but this will be a good a note section for you for later if you need to reference after the presentation.
Thank you, Kara. This is Jennifer Johnson. I'm just going to start to discuss some details for applying for Ohio Works benefits here in Ohio. Pardon me. Of course that happens right when I'm getting ready to speak. Here in Ohio, we have one application where participants can submit an application for all types of benefits, including Medicaid, tax assistance, and food assistance. Applications can be submitted at any one of our 88 county agencies. They can be submitted through the mail as well, and they can also be submitted online. The interviews are then done by a case manager, and they can be done either face-to-face or by telephone. And once an applicant is determined they're eligible for Ohio Works First, they're then determined if they are potentially a LEAP participant, and at that point they are referred for a LEAP assessment. As Kara mentioned, eligibility for LEAP, the targeted population are teen custodial parents under the age of 19 or pregnant teens under the age of 19 who have not obtained a high school diploma or the equivalent. As far as their living arrangements, the teens can either be living on their own or living with their parents or other caretaker relatives, legal guardians, or legal custodians. Okay, so once they refer for the LEAP program for the LEAP initial assessment, the teen parent must attend the initial LEAP assessment and orientation interview. At this point, a lot of information is discussed with the teen parent with some forms or the LEAP agreement they sign, which discusses a lot of the bonuses and penalties, which I'll be going over in a few moments. Also, a booklet to keep handy with them with a lot of questions and answers, along with more information as far as the penalties, bonuses, and also a school information release form, which they sign to give the county agency permission to obtain attendance information from the school they are attending. The program goals are discussed, types of educational opportunities available, supportive services. And also during this initial assessment, it is determined whether or not the teen might meet an exemption from participation in the LEAP program. The three top exemptions from the program would be either the caretaker has a child under the age of 12 weeks old. That will exempt them from participation in the LEAP program. They are also exempt from participation if they are currently being homeschooled or they are participating in an online or internet school. If they are participating in those types of schools, they are exempt from LEAP participation and they are not eligible for any of the bonuses I'll be talking about shortly. There's a variety of other exemptions that they could meet, such as unavailability of child care, unavailability of transportation, illness by either the caretaker or the child, or if they were expelled from school and is unable to attend any school. For exemptions such as those, like I said, they're exempt from participating in the LEAP program, but the county agency is required to have them participate in some type of alternative work activity in order to continue to receive OWF benefits. And then once they continue to be LEAP eligible, ongoing LEAP case management, they do have a specific case manager whom they would need to contact if they have any questions. The only other contact they have with them is usually once a year to redetermine their benefit eligibility. They are not required to go through a LEAP reassessment, but any issues are addressed at that time, such as attendance and progress and any other help the teen parent may need. Okay, I mentioned bonuses. The program offers bonuses for based on completion at each level. There is an enrollment bonus of $100, and that is issued in the month that they enroll in school. After that, they can receive a monthly attendance bonus of $62. These are based on attendance reports that are sent out monthly to the school. And we kind of work on, it's called a retrospective cycle, but the way the attendance bonuses are issued is 3 months after the attendance month. So if an individual attended fully in the month of September, they will receive their September bonus in the payment month of December. And then it just works on a cycle after that. Based on the attendance reports, if the county agency receives an attendance report an attendance report on the teen parent and there are four or fewer absences with no more than two that are unexcused, are eligible for a monthly attendance bonus. That they can receive a grade completion bonus of $100 that's issued upon verification of completion of the grade. And after that, they can receive a graduation bonus of $500 issued in the month that the school verifies they have completed. Okay, along with bonuses, they do have penalties for certain things they're not participating in. Failure to appear for the initial LEAP assessment, which I talked about, or failure to enroll in school or withdraw in school results in a penalty. What happens if the teen parent is removed from the benefit amount? It does not affect the remaining benefit amount for the child or for the children. If the teen is under 18, they are ineligible until they comply with that requirement, until they decide to attend the assessment interview or enroll in, or re-enroll in school. The initial assessment or fail to enroll in school, we treat them a little differently. At that point, they're referred to work activity participation. They are still not eligible for OWF. They are still removed from the benefit amount. The children are still eligible, but they, at that point, in order to continue to receive benefits for the rest of their family, they must participate in work activities. That's what we refer to as a non-recipient work-eligible individual. So basically, if you're a teen parent who's 18, you either have to participate in LEAP or participate in work activities. And once they fail to participate in work activities, as you know, work-eligible individual, it can affect the benefits for the entire family. Another LEAP penalty we have is the attendance penalty. And if they have attended school during the month, but they did not have good attendance for that month. Basically, if they have four or more absences, and they do not have good cause for those attendance failures, the grant amount for that month, the benefit amount for that month, is reduced by $62. And this works as the same as the bonuses. If they did not attend all of the days they're supposed to in the month of September, it'll affect their grant amount in the month of December. Once the county agency receives attendance reports back from the schools that they did have absences for the month, there is time taken from the county agency to contact the individual, say, we've received information, you're absent these days from school, what's the reason, is there good cause? If good cause is not provided, then at that point the penalty is taken. And that's a brief overview of our Ohio Learning and Earning and Parenting Program.
Great. Lisa, we actually have three questions in the queue for LEAP. Should we go ahead and ask those?
Sure, Louisa.
Okay, great. The first question is, are homeless teens eligible for those living in shelters or transitional housing?
Okay, I'm sorry. Could you repeat that, please?
Are homeless teens eligible, such as those living in shelters or transitional housing?
Yes.
Great. All right. The next question is, what is the proportion of teen moms and teen dads in your caseload?
We have a general number. We wouldn't have that breakdown. If there's someone who would like a little more information on our caseload, we can see if we can possibly get that for them if they wanted to send us an email. Our contact information is on the next slide.
Okay, great. The next question is, do the parents participate in a parenting education program? And if so, what curriculum do you use?
Yeah, the parenting education piece would really be dependent on the specific county. I know some counties do have some specific programs, but as a state, we don't have any mandatory curriculum.
Okay. Great. What supports are provided beyond meeting once a year?
Okay.
If transportation was an issue, we may be able to provide assistance with that, whether it be a bus pass or reimbursement for gas.
Okay.
Send to and from school.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks, Louisa. I think we should move on to the next presenters.
Yep.
And then hold the other questions until the end. If we don't get to all of your questions and answers, we will be posting answers to the questions on the website, on the PeerTA website, as soon as they are available. So I just want to thank Jennifer, who is the policy developer for Ohio State and Federal Cash Assistance Programs, and Kara, who is the policy section chief in Ohio LEAP. Our next presenters are Danette Lawrence and Henry Jones. Danette is the supervisory case manager for the Teen Parent Assessment Program, and Mr. Henry Jones is the social worker with the Teen Parent Assessment Program. And we look forward to hearing about their program. Thank you so much. So I'll turn this over to Danette and Henry.
Hello, everyone. This is Danette Lawrence with the Teen Parent Assessment Program. I'm a part of the Department of Human Services. Tanis.
And this is Henry Jones, social worker. Thank you for joining us today and us joining you.
As we advance to the slide where it gives an overview of our program consists of two case managers and one social worker. We service any youth who's 18 and under and has been identified as a teen parent who does not reside with a legal parent or guardian. Once we are provided with that information, once they come in and they complete an application for assistance, we then go out to certify their living arrangements to ensure that they're residing with someone who's responsible, who can assist them through the process of aiding them in parenting their child. Once we successfully certify that they're living with someone responsible, we then develop what we call a living, an individual responsibility plan. That plan is developed primarily by the teen parent. So if the teen parent feels that they need assistance with school, they may need assistance with daycare, they may need assistance with parenting, the plan actually reflects what they believe will enhance them and help them move towards self-sufficiency.
Now, we've been in existence since 1998. However, there's a new sheriff in town, and it's called Panic Redesign. So although our mandated cases are those under 18 and under, we will help anyone. We get telephone referrals or walk-ins, or we are at community events, and we disseminate brochures and pamphlets and speak to persons and counsel them. So we don't turn anyone down because, truth be known, it's the teen parent assessment program, which means that teens or sometimes adolescents 12 years old have had children, so you're talking about children who have had other children. But of course society looks at them as needing to be responsible now, so in essence we're just trying to help them to become more empowered any which way we can.
And also as a component of our program, we also provide services such as workshops where we talk about prevention efforts. We also have what we do reality stores, a financial literacy workshop. We go into schools and community-based agencies to promote self-sufficiency as well as prevention.
And, you know, it's called Teen Parent Assessment Program, as I said, but really we're trying to motivate them to become more consciously aware and to prevent the onset of teen pregnancy, because as the studies show, next slide, please. As the studies show, there are a whole lot of problems becoming pregnant at an early age when you're ill-prepared for it. Of course, the statistics in the district kind of more curious than other places because we're smaller in size and we're not in a state. It's 59.1% pregnancies per 1,000 girls 15 to 19 years of age.
And although there's been a decrease in the decrease in the number of pregnant parenting teens in the district, and it's, as you can see, it's credited to the support of adolescents themselves, parents, local and teen pregnancy prevention advocacy, community-based organizations, we still see it as something that we need to work on, particularly due to the fact that DC has what they call now TANF redesign. We are now moving towards 60-month requirements, which means that after 5 years,
that's it.
A number of our girls will not be able to be eligible for TANF. So the goal is to get them ready so that when they get to the place where they have to transition off of assistance, that they are self-sufficient, that they do have education, that they do have the skills to get a job.
So we're dealing with a generational mindset of young persons who are on TANF because they've seen their mother and grandmother on TANF. But it's a new day and age now, and it's not for infinity anymore. So we try to help them help themselves as soon as possible so that they can get off TANF, because it's called temporary assistance to needy families, not thought of to be permanent.
And as we advance to the next slide, we do have a few young people who have been successful in this program, a young lady named Marquita. These are some of the excerpts that she shared with us when we asked her what does she think has been helpful as it relates to what we do here every day. And if you go on, you'll advance to the next slide, you'll see our staff attending, baby showers. And if you go on to the next slide, which is unique, this is actually a young man who actually we submitted his application for Father of the Year Award, and he is right now, he has custody of his son.
Mm-hmm. Let me tell you that story really quickly. We collaborate with a lot of different organizations and agencies, and one is the Differential Response Unit within Child and Family Services. So they contacted us for me to go out and basically just try to help this young father, because his baby's mother literally left the baby, their baby, on his doorstep on Father's Day and said, now you take care of him, just like that. So he was 17 years old at the time, ill-prepared, of course, you know, to be a father. So first thing is I want to know where his mindset was. Are you willing to take on this responsibility? He didn't answer immediately, yes or no. He thought about it, which was a good sign. So over the next, course of the next few months, I was able to get him on TANF, get him enrolled in the right school curriculum, obtain child care for the child. As you can read, he was a starting running back on the football team. That was his passion at first, but he was able to realize that the child needed to be first and foremost and football second. Consequently, I submitted his name to the White House Initiative on Fatherhood, and they actually honored him as a champion of change, and we've seen a marked improvement ever since. So that's one of the success stories that we certainly want to acknowledge. Next slide, please.
And as you can see, this is just a piece of what we do called the Reality Sources Financial Literacy Workshop, where we go out to the schools and we work with the kids on developing a budget, how to, you know, manage a household. And it's just not for pregnant and parenting teens, but all teens.
You're right, because everybody needs to know about financial literacy and awareness. And it's a really fun exercise. There's simulated stations of where the person can go around with a booklet of a profession that they've chosen and that salary that's commensurate with that profession. But then they realize they don't have as much money as they thought initially. Because after, first of all, housing, child care, food, clothing, whatever else comes up, unexpected things in life, then you're really kind of short. So I'm the automotive salesman. So they come to me, of course, wanting a Beamer or a Lexus or a Benz, and sometimes they just have to leave with a bus pass to get around, but they realize that's the reality of their situation.
Next slide,
please.
And as you said earlier, part of being a teen parent is just not about the mother, but we also try to pull in the father as well. And we also conduct workshops. Mr. Jones, he conducts workshops primarily for teen fathers geared towards self-esteem, relationships. So this is just an excerpt of one of the workshops that we've conducted throughout the city.
And that's my picture. I'm also the ring announcer for professional boxing in the district. Having been for the last 25 years. And as you know, with youngsters, you got to impress them, first of all. So So I go in and I show them a boxing clip of me on HBO or ESPN announcing to get their attention, but that's just the hook. And then I talk to them about conflict resolution, domestic violence awareness, personal responsibility, anti-bullying, of course, healthy relationships, and the like. And certainly, you know, you have to reach them before you can teach them. So fortunately, I've been able to do that. Mm-hmm. Next slide, please.
And the next slide is just an overview of some of our graduates. My most recent is over to the left. We always like to show that, you know, there is a, you know, a light at the end of the tunnel. And the majority of our caseload, they really have a desire to, you know, get to the end of the road. They'll see the light at the end of the tunnel. And we find that, you know, because of the way we do our case management, if you come in at 14, we'll work with you until you're 18. Now, as we stated earlier, because of TANF redesign, they're now asking us to take on 21-year-olds and 22-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, when, you know, the overall caseload in the district of TANF recipients is 17,000. Anyone, the number of, out of that, 1,973 are 22-year-olds. Out of that number, number of the 105 are under 18. So we're looking at really more than 10% of the overall population of TANF recipients are under 22.
And we realize that post-secondary education is not for everyone. That's the reality of it. They didn't do good in school, so, you know, reality is you can't expect them to try to get into college and do good when that's not their mindset. So we try to collaborate with other agencies, vocational agencies. I had one young man who was caught up in a juvenile detention system because he liked to hot wire cars, you know, going in 60 seconds type thing, take them to chop shops and, you know, flip that for money, you know, where they sell those parts. And so that was his hustle. He just kept getting caught and, you know, didn't have any fear of going to jail because he was a juvenile. But I was able to get him to see that if he was to get his automotive a licensed mechanic and become a licensed mechanic, to make honest money every day of his life, and that's exactly what he did. He became a certified auto mechanic. Had another young man, he wouldn't go to school, but he would go to the video arcades 25 hours a day if he could, because that was his thing, playing those video games. He mastered just about everything he ever played. So a few summers ago, I was able to get him an internship at EA Sports. And he's working now in IT. So we try to help them help themselves and let them realize everyone has skills and talents. You just have to find out what it is and what they are and certainly pursue it and be passionate about it.
And the last slide is just an overview of the various community agencies and partners that we have that make this work. Because without the community being involved in this process, none of this we wouldn't be able to do our job. So this is the end of our presentation, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Danette and Henry. This was Greg and Karen and Jennifer. Both of your programs were very exciting. I'm really glad to hear that how you're helping young people. I am going to turn this over to Louisa Jones to facilitate the questions and answers. Louisa?
Yes, thank you to all four presenters. We actually have a lot of questions that came in, so I'll try to do my best to get as many answered as we possibly can. So the first question for Danette and Henry from D.C., people are interested in what financial literacy curriculum you use, and is it available to others?
Well, actually, it's called the Reality Store, and what we actually were able to get it offline. There are various school systems, and actually, it started, I believe, in Texas, where someone had developed what they call, it's actually called the Reality Store. And the way that it's structured is that it actually stems from banking, just general banking. And what we did is we pulled pieces together from off of the internet. You can actually go on the internet and type in Reality Store. And what we did was we developed a financial literacy piece based on the current population that we were working with, because we found that the overall reality stores that they had online did not meet some of the realistic needs that we thought that would be able to aid our kids in basically getting a really good view of what it is to actually be able to maintain a household. And what we did is we incorporate pieces as it relates to being a teen parent. So we talk about how much it costs to buy diapers, how much it costs to get formula. So what we did is we just took bits and pieces of reality stores that we found online, and we completed one for our program specifically.
Great. Thank you. There are several questions about caseload in terms of how many teen parents you serve, and especially the mix between how many fathers you actually serve.
Well, as of right now, we have one father on our caseload. We have 188 individuals that we work with, and out of that, it's just one father. What we've discovered that it's kind of difficult to pull the fathers in unless they are parenting the children themselves. That's on an ongoing basis. So some of those young people have been with us since they were 14. I have a case manager now who has two young ladies that he's worked with since they were 14. One is in the 11th grade and one's in the 12th grade. So as I see it expanding to be inclusive of 21-year-olds, I see that our caseload will probably grow.
And that's only one, formal case. Personally, I work with the teen parents and the fathers in particular through other agencies with the Mayor's Fatherhood Initiative. So there are various organizations that have services for teen fathers, and I've collaborated with them in order to make referrals and provide services. I would say overall probably numbering 100 or more of services that we provide indirectly.
Great.
Louisa?
Yep.
Hi. Can we remind everyone if to make sure that your question is in the queue, if you would address them to all co-presenters or address them to Louisa Jones, so that Louisa is queuing the question. So please address your questions to all co-presenters or to Louisa Jones. Thank you.
And and thank you, Lisa. That's a nice reminder. If you do want to submit a question, the chat button is on the bottom left-hand corner, and all you have to do is type in your question, and you can pick all co-presenters or myself, Louisa Jones. So I'm going to have one more question for DC, and I've got several others, but I'm going to go back to Ohio Leaf after this. In terms of mental health counseling or referrals, do you provide those to the teen parents?
Oh, absolutely. You know, especially younger persons who are going through relationship issues. Of course, they're playing house, for lack of a better term, and all that comes with that, which is domestic violence and, you know, teens just being teens. So we found out that there's a lot of loss, a lot of grief, and there needs to be a lot of healing. So one of our big partners is the WENT. WENDT Center for Loss, Grief, and Healing, and we make referrals there. And we actually had a presenter come in from WENT Center this past week for the summer youth employee programs that we're monitoring. Matter of fact, tomorrow is the last day. Yay! You know, but know that kids will be kids, basically. And they're going through a lot of anxiety. And a lot of times adults don't realize or don't want to remember how they were as adolescents and teens. It's a very precarious time in your life with your body developing differently. And, of course, you finding out where you fit in society or if you fit in at all and questioning your skills and talents and abilities. So, yes, mental health, well-being is very definitely the key.
Okay, great. And so I'll come back to some additional questions that have been submitted for Danette and Henry in a second, but Jennifer and Kara, I'm going to go back to some questions that came in for both of you. One question is about where does the funding come from for this program?
It actually comes from our TANF allocation. Since they're TANF recipients, the bonuses are issued through that program. We also have, the way it works is similar to our prevention, retention, and contingency program. So it's, you know, those are, that program is for short-term needs. So it's similarly done in that manner where in our eligibility system, the worker can go in and the funds go directly from our TANF allocation.
Great, thank you. Is there any help with childcare during classes?
Yes. The question came up earlier regarding supportive services. We do help with childcare, transportation. Some of the counties have classes such as parenting classes or family planning, stress management, substance abuse. They also will help with housing assistance and paternity establishment if necessary. These are just examples of things that we've had come up in the past. And then there's also nutrition information that's provided in some of the counties. So it does vary based on the county, and obviously the involvement varies based on the county because we put the program out there and it's up to the county to utilize it. And we would, of course, love to see more people participating because we do believe that the bonuses do help the participants involved. But unfortunately, we can't mandate that. So this is just another option available to them.
Thank you. I have a very similar question in terms of the ongoing case management services that you provide. How do you also address barriers to attending school?
So we only certify them once a year. That's our certification periods are generally 12 months. A county could decide, you know, they have the option to do 4, 5, or 6 months, but generally they do 12 months. However, since we do monitor the attendance bonuses monthly, we get monthly reports of that. When a county sees someone that's failing or has multiple failures where they're going to be penalized, they should be following up with them at that point to see, one, if there's an issue with the placement, then is it because there's a barrier of transportation or childcare, or is this just not a good fit and you need a different assignment? So although we only force that conversation once a year generally for certification, they do have monthly or bi-monthly, depending on how the attendance comes in, but generally that's monthly review of if they're meeting it, and if they're not, they should be contacting them.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. I have one more question specific for you, Jennifer and Kara, and then I actually have two questions that actually apply to both programs. Kara and Jennifer, are the grandparents required to participate in your program?
One second.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Regarding the grandparents, depending on the household composition, the teen parent and his or her child are in the household with the grandparents. It's the grandparents' option to be included if we call them in need, if they want to be included in the grant, but they do not have to. If the grandparents choose to be in the grant amount with the teen parents, they are required to participate in work activities.
Okay. Thank you. And the question for both programs, in terms of tracking outcomes, working with the sets of teen parents and also with the fathers, what kind of outcomes do you track, and also what kind of outcomes have you seen in terms of improvement or progression to giving them services?
Okay.
This is Ohio, and we can start. Unfortunately, we don't have a great answer to that because our tracking for this program is basically back from the time when it was created back in 1988, it feels like. We do get reports on the number of bonuses issued, and we have another report that gives us the number of people that were assigned and assessed for the program. But as far as, like, an evidence-based, like, the graduation rate, or we don't have a report that compiles all that. We would have to go to the county agencies. You know, we could do a little bit based on how many $500 graduation bonuses were issued, but we don't have a great repository, I guess, for we don't have that information readily available.
Okay. Our measurable outcomes are measured by the number of graduates from high school or GED programs, as well as those that go on to post-secondary education, those who get jobs, those who do not have a repeat pregnancy. That's huge, because certainly, you know, we don't want them to have two children at 16 years of age, because and that's just doubly hard. Also, by the lack of domestic violence in situations, that they finally have come to a place of peace in their mind, because they realize that that child needs to be the emphasis, and you know, not the emotional relationship that they were in. That's probably it.
Okay.
But if someone was looking for more specific numbers, there was over the I've been with the program for going on 3 years, and over the last two, they've been working on pulling together a system where we can compile that information and pull it out. Because Mr. Jones has been with the program since it started, he can speak to a lot of the process as well as the numbers. I mean, we've been in existence for 14 years, and we've had had a total of three repeat pregnancies.
That we know of.
That we know of, based on the fact that we do a lot of follow-up. Most of our girls will keep in touch with us, but we're trying to work on developing something that's tangible where we can be able to go in and actually pull out information.
And, of course, a living, a stable living environment. When we get them, they use the pillar to post, you know, living anywhere, taking the baby with them or not. So we try to let them see that being stable, having a roof over your head, just those basic things that they had taken for granted, they now don't have, and they need to have that as a prerequisite to success.
Okay. Great. Thank you to both programs. The next joint question is, how are both of you working with child welfare to engage pregnant and parenting teens in foster care, or are you?
Well, with TPAP, if you are identified as being in the custody of Child and Family Services, we don't work with you, because there's two government agencies performing the same process. So
we won't open a case.
Yeah,
we cannot officially open a case, but we can
collaborate. Say that there's that they need assistance with referrals for parenting programs, or the teen's parent needs assistance. But as it relates, we can't officially open a case if they're in the custody of the state.
For LEAP, in our program, the individual, if the child is in foster care and they were no longer a custodial parent, LEAP wouldn't be an avenue we would pursue for them. However, if they were a custodial parent but needing help with some information on foster care, adoption, anything of that nature, we would go over that with them in their interview or their assessment and help them. You know, it's all under our agency, so we would get them to the appropriate contact in the county agency and move their assessment forward from there.
Great. Thank you. I actually have one more joint question. In terms of both of your programs, were they both locally developed, or did you use any type of evidence or literature or examples of other programs to help inform your program development?
Yeah, for TPAP, ours is very definitely locally developed. Of course, over the years, it's morphed into, you know, something that has become a monster, really, because we're having a lot of persons who have been on TANF now for close to those 5 years. Some have been on beyond the 5 years, but they haven't been sanctioned because we didn't have mechanisms in place for their transition and to meet their needs after TANF. So it was locally developed, and we've been more, I would say, lenient than other states traditionally and historically over years with that 5-year moratorium. But as I said when I first started, it's the new sheriff in town, and people are transitioning off, and the truth of the matter is, we're really not equipped to deal with those persons who have lack of education and lack of job skills. So that's the conundrum we're in right now.
Great. Thank you. There's
there's several questions for both programs in terms of, I think people want more clarity around how often you meet with the students and then also the reality stores for DC. How often are those held? Can you both give us some more clarity?
Oh, the reality stores are basically based on what we do is that we go out and we meet with different schools, programs, community agencies. We could do two or three reality stores a month, one or two reality stores a week. It's based on whether or not the schools have the space and they're where it's available for them to conduct them. Because we had summer youth workers here, we do it with them as well for the last two summers. And what was the other question?
About how often we meet.
Oh,
we meet on an as-needed basis, but...
Majority of the time it is weekly. So if it depends on the individual and the intensity of the case.
Right.
I have one case manager who has three young ladies that he meets with twice a week, and he talks to them daily. So it depends on where they are as it relates to the individual responsibilities plan.
Mm-hmm.
We do have young ladies that we touch base with them on a weekly basis because the way our program works, all of our interactions either happen in the home or the school, and we try to get away from the phone because it doesn't afford us the opportunity to actually see what's going on. We do keep contact by phone, but we do school visits and we do home visits.
Mm-hmm.
We also go to the shelters if they're in the shelters. So we try to meet them where they're at so that coming to see us is not another barrier.
Thank you. In terms of for DC, somebody wants to know, is it really just three workers who do all the individual cases in the workshop?
That's what we've been trying to tell them. We need help.
No, yeah.
Or do you have fun?
Amazing, isn't it?
Because I'm fairly new to the program, I believe they had there were more workers involved, but we are down to three. And because of the support from my community partners, we're able to do this. I believe it takes a village, and we get through it on a daily basis. As I say, I keep going back to that one case manager. I don't know if I keep assigning him a specific type of case, but at times I will assist him as well because some of his young ladies need more attention than others. We've just been fortunate that a good percentage of our girls, because they develop their own IRPs, they stick with them, and we can actually walk them through the process because the goal is to help them understand what self-sufficiency means to them. So I take it on that positive spin. We make it work.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I put in 30 years last month on the job, and I went out on this one case, and it was a young lady. She had two children. She was 16, and she was sucking her thumb as she was listening to what I had to say. And I put my head down, and she said, "Are you tired, Mr. Jones?" And I looked up, and it hit me. I'm talking to a child who has had children, and I told her, I said, "You have no idea," you know. You know, so we do as much as we can. We work smarter, not harder. That's why we involve a lot of other community agencies to help us in this task because we certainly can't do it all.
Great. Thank you. I have two questions I'm going to try to combine around domestic violence. To whom is the bonus awarded for nonviolence, the victim or the alleged perpetrator?
And to whom is that question directed?
I think that's for Kara and Jennifer.
Could you repeat that question? I'm sorry.
Yeah, the question was in terms of domestic violence, when you award the bonus for nonviolence, is that bonus awarded to the victim or the alleged perpetrator for nonviolent behavior?
We don't have the measurement for domestic violence. I think that was the DC program.
Okay.
Our bonuses are strictly based on school attendance, grade completion, graduation, accomplishments.
Okay.
No, we never said we had any money for that.
I don't understand the question because we don't do any cash rewards. So I don't. Maybe I misunderstood the question.
Okay. So I guess so. What I'm hearing here for clarification for the person who asked the question is that there is no bonus awarded around nonviolence. Okay. From best program. Okay. Let's see. In terms of the time clock issue, I think Henry, you mentioned that potentially for youth who start under the age of 18, that their time starts on TANF and count towards the total 60 months. Is that really true, that they could actually be off of TANF even before they turn 21?
Well, see, at this point, that's where we're at, and because they're in the process of redesigning it, I know there's been some discussion about looking at if they're in school that the clock would actually stop, but I can't, that's not something that actually has happened as of yet. As of right now, based on the TANF redesign, that is a strong possibility. And being that, you know, it could happen, we've always done individual responsibility plans. The goal has always been self-sufficiency, but now it's intensified because of the changes in the district, the girls actually see it as something that could happen. It's been a discussion, but now it's getting pretty close to a reality.
Yeah.
So I do know that there has been discussions about looking at the 18-year-olds and under, but at this point in time, I don't know where that is at. But I know that it's something that has come up, because when you think about it, the clock starts when you apply, mm-hmm. and, you know, I don't know if when you think about 10, if you think about teenagers, but
it's subject to.
Yeah,
and
so,
they start receiving TANF at 14, at 19, 5 years later, that's it.
19, 20.
You can't get it anymore.
Yeah.
So 5 months, 5 years, 60 months. That's the deal.
Yeah, because I know it's there.
And Karen, Jennifer, do you have any similar reflections on that or challenges you've seen?
No, the only question I would want to go back to is if it was local or evidence-based.
Yeah.
And although our program was locally based and established, we did do it in phases. And from 1988 to 96, during that period, we only gave attendance bonuses, the $62, and we also had the $62 penalty. And then in 96, we decided that we saw an increase in attendance among those in the program, so we wondered if with giving additional bonuses would be effective. So that's when we added the graduation bonus and the grade completion bonus, the $100 and the $500. So we did do that in phases because we did see some positive results. Unfortunately, we haven't done a full assessment to see if the graduation and the grade completion have made the effect we were hoping for back then, but obviously that's where we've ended. Just to throw out how we established where we are today.
That's wonderful. Yeah, thank you for going back to that question. For the VC program, are there supports for teen parents living with their parents through your program?
No, throughout the way it works is that if a child is not a teen parent is not living with their parent, there is that they are afforded the opportunity to get their own grant. If they're living with their parent, then the assistance would come through the parent's grant. So the majority of the young ladies that we serve, they are classified as head of household because they're not living with their legal parent or guardian. But if they were living with their legal parent or guardian and their parent was eligible, then the assistant would come through their parent's grant.
Now, when you said support, were you referencing financial support or just support in general?
Support in general.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah,
as I said earlier, we turn no one down. We're trying to help everybody help themselves. So whatever their need is, we look into trying to make that referral to the appropriate agency to get them that help.
For example, we have a family where we work with the mother. We work with the mother because the daughter was identified. We were able to get the mother in the same GED program as the daughter. So if we go in and we recognize that you know, part of the child's individual responsibility plan is also to stabilize her overall family, then we do extend our services to the parent, because that's where, or the individual identified as a responsible adult, we will work with them, because we've discovered that if we can stabilize everyone or make attempt to do that, then we get a better outcome. And so that has worked in our favor, because when the individuals that these young women live with and young men live with see that, you know, we're helping one person, we extend services. Like the young man who is the only teen parent in our program, we realized that their family needed some assistance, and so we extended some services through other agencies within our agencies that were able to support them with some financial help. So yeah, we look at, it's a holistic approach. We help the entire unit.
Do you, for DC, do you actually assist in other states?
No, just the district. You have to be a district resident in order to apply for TANF in a district. So, but if someone called from another state and said they needed information, we could provide you with basic referrals, but to provide any kind of services, no.
Okay, great. Lisa, I think I have a few more questions, but I'm going to pick maybe three more questions, and then should we just promise that we're going to follow up with the other questions to the presenters?
I think that's a great idea, Louisa.
Okay, great. This question goes back to the domestic violence piece. For the 60 months, for those who may be experiencing domestic violence or partner violence or sexual assault, are they given any type of family violence waiver?
Yeah, the TANF redesign has worked in this way. What they're starting to do is, like, it's a holistic approach. An individual will come in. They will get an assessment. They're now using a term called individual responsibility plan. If a person has any of those issues present at the time, they will get a referral to a domestic violence program. If they come in exhibiting mental health issues, it'll be referred to DMH. And if I'm not mistaken, if there's some issues with domestic violence, I believe that the requirements as it relates to employment as well as the 60 months, that is waived, based on the fact that a person who is in a domestic violence situation may not be able to work based on the fact that they are, you know, in a situation where they can't be out there working because of some of the threats of violence that have occurred. So there are things in place based on the TANF redesign. They're looking at the whole picture. So in order for people to move towards self-sufficiency, we have to address all the issues. And that is the unique thing that has happened with this new 60 months. We're beginning to look at individuals who are coming in the door in a different way, affording them the opportunity to not only get assistance with job readiness and employment or education, but if there are other issues that are occurring, we can provide them with the support so that when we get to the place of doing job readiness or referring them for a job, they're stabilized.
Great, thank you. Here's a question for both programs. This is kind of going back to how the teen parents actually come into your programs in the first place. What reasons do you see about why teens are getting pregnant or need your services? How are they getting there? Is it lack of education, that type of thing?
And how long is this webinar now? Wow. That's a loaded question. But what I've seen, this is the TPAP program, from what I've seen, there are some commonalities. Hate to say it, but it's the truth. Lack of a father in the household seems to be one of the big ones. That young ladies are going out looking for love, of course, in all the wrong places. You know, and they hear those three words, and they've never heard "I love you" before. Well, you know, they're all in then. You know, sometimes they're looking for somebody else to love, thinking that baby will be the object of their affection, but not realizing that baby has needs of its own. You know, I've seen that if there's not a father in the home, a young lady really doesn't know how to relate to a young man. You know, and by the same token, if and how a young man treats his mother is usually how he's going to treat that young lady. You know, of course, there's extenuating circumstance and exceptions to every rule. But those are the things that I see, you know, that they think they can get a child and get out on their own, get their own money, get their own apartment, and be happily ever after. And of course, you know, reality sets in and, you know, they realize, wow, this is not what I thought, but out of spite, I'm not going back home. Not that they can't go back home, but because of those egos involved, and, you know, they choose not to go back home. Now, in some cases I've seen, they really don't need to be in that home, because I went out on a case 14 years ago, and I'm thinking it was just a wayward child, you know, disrespecting her mother, until she showed me that she was actually the one running the household because her mother was a substance abuser. And that opened my eyes, you know, that these children or young persons are growing up much quicker than my generation did. So we certainly got have to help them help themselves.
And I would just summarize that by saying the other issue, too, is self-esteem on both sides, just not the young women, but the young men as well,
mm-hmm.
and trying to figure out who they are and where they fit in, and having access to prevention methods such as birth control, condoms, and all that other information is helpful. But I think that what we find as we talk to each of these young ladies, just trying to get them to a place where they're comfortable within their own skin. And having a child, for some of them, brings that back around because they realize that they have to be responsible for someone else. And so I think the component of the program that I appreciate the most is the workshops that we do. Where we go out and we talk about self-esteem, and we go out and talk about what defines a positive relationship is the added addition. And I also think that if you look at some of the literature, one of the things that a lot of our teens say is that they need that authoritative person. They need somebody to have to talk to, somebody that they can go to in time of confusion. And I think that having the support of a positive, responsible adult is a positive factor and turning the tide in some of the behaviors that we may see.
And Karen, Jennifer, I don't know if you want to take a chance.
I think they covered it very well. I don't think we have anything to add to that.
Okay.
I would also say this, that the male is usually that forgotten part of that equation of teen pregnancy and teen pregnancy prevention. So it's imperative that we reach them as early as possible. You know, junior high school is too late, really. They're being inundated with media images and suggestions and, you know, you know what it is out there that glamorizes sex, drugs, the fast life, you know, the women, the cars. So even at the I would say probably elementary school nowadays, because their IQs are really higher than ours. You know, I stopped playing video games with Pac-Man, you know. And of course, these kids now, they're mastering all kind of levels, you know, with the video games. So don't think they're too young to understand. You know, they're part of the solution at an early age nowadays, and we need to think of it that way and design curriculums to address them.
Thank you both. I'm going to ask one final question, and this is actually from somebody who is in a state that actually doesn't have this type of program that works with teen parents specifically. And do you have any kind of lessons learned in terms of things that they could possibly go to take advantage of some of the resources around working with teen parents, even if their states or counties don't actually have those programs?
Well, yeah, just one, and that is that, well, maybe two. We can't solve all problems, but they have the resources within themselves to see how they can help themselves, and they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care, as I read somewhere. So you got to establish that one-on-one rapport with them to motivate them to help themselves. And those are where the answers will come from.
Tara, Jennifer?
I think our biggest suggestion would be to definitely look at your community resources. I know that our counties often feel like they don't have the support in their communities, but then when they go out and look for it and make and build those relationships with their community link centers and the groups that are already working on similar topics in their area, they definitely are welcomed with open arms when they want to try to partner with each other. So I think that, you know, definitely just looking at the resources already available and seeing how you can utilize them. The biggest problem we have in Ohio is that each year we have a biennial budget process, and although this program is not a high-dollar program by any means, you know, unfortunately, we don't have the numbers big enough and enough evidence-based research to defend the people who say, well, could we take this money elsewhere with all the budget cuts we have? So we fight every 2 years to keep this program because we do feel it's important, especially for those that are enrolled and involved. We'd love to build that, and unfortunately, at some point when we're not so focused on work participation for the TANF program, hopefully that will be something we can focus on again.
Great. All right. And Lisa, there's just one or two other questions that have been coming in, but we will make sure that we send those questions to the presenters and so they can respond to those questions.
Okay. Liz, one question I see up that I would like to ask, and
okay.
Lisa, if you don't mind, and that is, are there any challenges with reaching males?
Yes.
Absolutely.
What we find is that when we go out to do an assessment, one of the things that is a part of our initial assessment is that we'll ask if you are aware, know the whereabouts of the father. Depending on whether the father is present or not, or the relationship has soured or not, or the factor that comes into play is that I don't want to get him in trouble with child support.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to get past that piece by just basically saying, you know, if we help you, we can help him. That way you wouldn't have to worry about the piece of child support. Maybe we could assist him in getting into school so that he can, too, get employment or vice versa. But we find it difficult to pull them in because when most people talk about teen parents, unless you say teen fathers, it's not, from what we can see, it's not part of the equation. And pulling them in for us is sometimes problematic because unless they are physically there with the teen parent at the time that we go to the home or we make our visit, a good percentage of the girls won't even divulge that they're in existence.
And, you know, often, more than not, the teen fathers get a bad rap of being deadbeats, but they're just dead broke. So we try to connect them with resources, with programs to take advantage of their interests so that they can become more involved in that child's life. One of the things that we're dealing with, though, and I've spoken to the chief of police here in the district about it, is older males and the younger girls. Because in the district, if it's 4 years or more age difference, that's statutory rape. So if you're talking about a 20-year-old and a 16-year-old, well, on the books is statutory rape. But the reality is, if they were to get together and have a child, nobody's going to do anything about it because, quote, it's consensual. So that's the catch-22. If it's on the books, it's supposed to be enforced as statutory rape. But if there are no charges brought, there's nothing we can do about it. So theoretically, you could have a 50-year-old, okay, and a teenager, you know, having sex, and nobody does anything about it because no charges are brought. But what that's doing is, it's kind of like condoning a pedophile situation in my mind. So we're really trying to get that out there to make them more aware that this is not right and something needs to be done. So we're supposed to have that dialogue with the police department to see what we can do about it, as well as with child welfare.
Thank you, Henry and Jeanette. Kara, Jennifer, do you have concerns?
You know, I think it's a little different for us because we probably have the same success rate because our counties, for males and females, because our counties are assessing them based on they've come in to apply. They want the OWF benefits. Now we're determining if they're also eligible for LEAP. So they're there. They're ready to participate, and they know they're going to be assigned to something. So I don't think we have the same issues, but we probably would see that we have more males than or females than males on the program, just because, you know, they can come in and apply for Medicaid and food assistance once they're in that 6 month pregnancy, and also get LEAP at the same time. So I think we do have a little bit of a different circumstance.
Okay. Well, I thank you both. Thank you all, Jennifer and Kara and Danette and Henry, for giving us such great presentations, and then spending the time to answer the questions. I think it brought a richness to this webinar and made us understand a very difficult topic. One quick question is, we'll ask offline. It was about the, Louisa, what was Jane DeLage's question?
The name of the Lost Grief and Healing Program in D.C., what was the name for that?
I'm sorry, repeat that question.
Of the grief and healing program that you have in D.C., what was the name?
No, it's actually a center that provides that service called the WENT, W-E-N-D-T, WENT Center for Lost Grief and Healing. And actually, they have satellite offices that they've opened up in the district, which is kind of like a sad commentary in itself because of all the killings that we've had on, teen-on-teen crimes. But it is what it is. So, you know, we have probably about three or four offices now through WENT that we make referrals to.
Okay, thank you very much. Unfortunately, we have to close the question and answer. We will be highlighting all the questions and answers when we post the transcript with answers. So if your answer wasn't discussed during this particular session, we will have a written version posted online in the upcoming weeks. So, again, I want to thank our presenters. You were absolutely marvelous. For sharing your information. We hope that this webinar has been beneficial to you and communicate that you serve and encourage and beneficial to the communities that you serve and encourage you to think about new ideas and next steps for your programs.
Thank you. I just want to encourage all my colleagues in this this struggle that, you know, don't give up on our youth. You know, help them help themselves. That if each one person does something, no one person has to do a lot. So I just want to encourage you in this task and stay empowered.
Thank you, Henry. I don't really want to speak after that because that was a great closing statement.
thank you.
We'll have the transcript and audio and Q&As posted on the PeerTA site in a couple of weeks. We want to ask you a few questions about how helpful this webinar has been to you. We can go to the polling questions. Next slide. If you could just answer, the speakers had valuable information to share. The speakers had valuable information to share. We'll give you a few seconds. I have a better understanding of the resources available to agencies to help serve teen parents. I have a better understanding of the resources available to teen parents. I have a better understanding of resources available to agencies to help serve teen parents. Thank you. Next slide. I have a better understanding of how strategies for overcoming barriers to service delivery and teen parent programs. I have a better understanding of our strategies for overcoming barriers to service delivery and teen parent programs. Next question. Today, I have learned about successful teen parent models. Okay, next slide. The logistics of this webinar ran smoothly. Next slide. Okay, thank you so much for participating in our poll, and thank you for participating in the webinar. Feel free to contact us by email. We are so very interested in if this is a useful TA methodology, as well as any potential topics. So we would really like to hear from you about potential topics for next fiscal year that you would like to hear. So would you please email us at peerta, P-E-E-R-T-A, at icf.i.com. If our potential webinar topics that you would like to learn more about next fiscal year. Thank you so much, and have a good afternoon.
Thank you. Likewise.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the webinar for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines.